bit my lip, the blood spraying everywhere like an exploding packet of ketchup. His smile grew wider as I fell to my knees. I was practically teed up for him, about to be lights out. We both knew it. The only thing delaying the inevitable was the one thing he wanted to know. He dangled the question as if it were my salvation, the only way he'd spare me. "Where is he?" he asked. "Where's the kid?" I was dizzy, nauseous. My vision was quickly narrowing, blurred and fuzzy around the perimeter. That was why I didn't see it at first, even though it was only a few feet to the left. My duffel. The chain of the zipper was catching just enough light from the naked bulb overhead. The pull tab was on the near side, within arm's reach. How fast do I need to be? Can I distract him? The answer came suddenly, with the piercing hiss of hydraulic pistons as the trash began to rumble all around us. It wasn't exactly divine intervention, but I wasn't complaining. This wasn't your ordinary dumpster. It was also a compactor, clearly triggered by weight, and it was about to do its job. For 1 second, he took his eyes off me. It was like a reflex hammer to the knee. He couldn't help it. He had to see what the hell was happening. That yes, the wall was closing in behind him. And that was all I needed. Just 1 quick second. Zip. Chapter 46. My hand dove into the duffel, feeling for the first piece of metal I could find. I pulled out the Glock as he turned back around. "Surprise, buddy. The wall's closing in from this side, too." I squeezed off 2 rounds right to his chest, his body thrashing as if he'd been jolted with electric paddles. He wasn't the only one shaking, though. I'd never shot anyone before. The feeling was otherworldly, and not in the good way. Trying to hold it together, I stood over him. His eyes were closed, his body motionless. The only thing missing was the coffin. Still, something wasn't right. There's something else missing. There should have been blood, lots and lots of it, staining his white shirt. The moment he opened his eyes was the moment I realized why there wasn't any. He was wearing a vest. The shots were still echoing in the dumpster as the hydraulics of the compactor suddenly hissed to a stop. Another sound, someone's voice, immediately filled the silence. "Gordon!" He now had a name. We both looked up at the chute. Gordon's partner was calling down to him. He'd undoubtedly heard the gunfire. With my Glock pointed at Gordon's head, I raised a finger to my lips. "Don't answer." I needed a moment to think, not that I really had one. "Gordon!" came the voice again, even louder. The only thing I knew for sure was that I didn't want his partner coming down for a visit. "Tell him you'll be right up," I said. Just in case Gordon had thoughts of his own, I tightened my grip on the Glock. As nervous as I must have looked, I'd already pulled the trigger twice. What Gordon wouldn't have given to know where he'd dropped his gun. He coughed, his face contorting with pain. The vest had stopped the shots, but the wind had been knocked clear out of him. He was struggling to catch his breath. "All good," he finally yelled. "I'll be up in a minute." I didn't look away, not for a second, as I leaned down to pick up the duffel with my free hand. "You have a badge?" I asked, only to see him shake his head. "How about a wallet?" "No." Strange thing was, I believed him. In his line of work, you don't really carry ID around with you. In any event, I wasn't about to risk searching him. "I should kill you," I said. "But you won't." He was right. Shooting a man in self-defense was one thing. Shooting him in cold blood was something else entirely. Something I wasn't. "Who's behind all this?" I asked. "Who wants the kid dead?" He just stared at me. If he knew, he wasn't telling. Where had I seen that before? Would I really be bothered by the moral implications of an injection that could make him tell me what I wanted to know? Nothing is ever black and white. Not even the truth.
Chapter 47. Real slowly, I said. I want you to pull up your right pant leg.
If I was ever going to leave that dumpster alive, I couldn't risk his having a second gun. He pulled up his pant leg to show me there was no shin holster. "Now your left one," I said. No shin holster there either.
"Satisfied?"
he asked. "Not yet," I said. "I want you to tie your shoelaces together." I was expecting him to give me a look that said, "You've got to be kidding me." Instead, he just said no.
"No?" "That's right," he said. "No."
But it was the way he said it. Cocksure. As if he'd suddenly regained all the leverage.
"Really?"
I knew exactly what he was thinking. Forget the shoelaces. If I couldn't kill him, the only things about to be tied were my hands. "Fine," I said. But it was the way I said it. And had he been paying a bit more attention, he would have stopped smiling well before I lowered my aim and fired one shot into his right foot.
"Motherfucker!"
he screamed, as the dime-sized hole in his black wingtip gurgled blood like a garden hose. He grabbed his foot, and I grabbed the side of the dumpster, climbing out with my duffel. I walked straight out the basement door to the back of my building, through the alley, and onto the sidewalk. As soon as I turned the corner, I hailed a cab. Only after telling the driver the address did I lean back in the seat and think about what I'd done, or more to the point, how I hadn't thought twice about doing it. Most people will live their entire lives believing they know exactly who they are and what they're capable of. But that's only because most people will never have to find out for real. I ran my tongue over my split lip, tasting the warmth and slight saltiness of my own blood. This was for real, all right. As real as it gets.
Chapter 48.
"Jesus Christ, what happened?" asked Owen as he opened the door. "Oh, nothing really," I said. "I just beat up a fist with my face, that's all." He leaned toward me for a closer look. The closer he got, the more he winced. "I'll go get some ice." He backtracked to grab the ice bucket near the television and headed off down the hallway while I put down my duffel and made a quick turn into the bathroom. I opened one eye slowly to the mirror. The other eye was already swollen shut.
"Cut me, Mick."
I washed off all the blood and gave the hand towels a proper burial in the garbage pail below the sink. Housekeeping could put them on our tab, because there wasn't enough bleach in the world to bring those puppies back to white. That got me wondering as Owen returned with a full ice bucket. I just wanted to make sure. "You didn't check in under Winston Smith again, did you?" "Of course not," he said. "Care to guess, though?" I wasn't really in the mood. Then again, I was the one who'd brought it up. "Fine," I said. "I'll take fake names for 500. Turns out the kid did a pretty decent impression of Alex Trebek. "Eric Arthur Blair," he said. I stared at him blankly with my one good eye. I had no clue. "What is George Orwell's real name?" he answered. Of course. The kid was as consistent as he was clever. That might have explained why he'd chosen to hide out in another hotel. This time in two adjoining rooms at the Stonington down in Chelsea. Frankly, though, I didn't know which genius to believe. On the one hand was Albert Einstein's definition of insanity. Doing the same thing over and over and expecting a different result. On the other hand was Owen channeling the Fodor's travel guide to Manhattan. "There are over 250 hotels in the city, totaling over 70,000 rooms, he informed me. "As long as you weren't followed here, I think we're good." He looked at me, cocking an eyebrow. That was my cue to assure him that no, I hadn't been followed to the hotel. "Besides," he added, "we're both in desperate need of some sleep, as well as showers." He sniffed the air around me. "And one of us is a little more desperate for that shower than the other, if you don't mind me saying. Where the hell were you?" After fashioning an ice pack from the liner bag in the ice bucket, I filled Owen in on where I'd been. The Times building, the luggage store, and the bank, hence the duffel and its contents. Then my apartment and, oh yeah, did I mention the dumpster? I would have preferred to leave out the part about Claire being pregnant, but that would have left unanswered the only question Owen could have had for me when I was done explaining, particularly about the trip to my apartment. "Are you freaking nuts?" Maybe I was, but at least he now knew why. "I'm very sorry," he said. "Thank you." He was staring at the carpet, a fresh wave of guilt over Claire's death crashing down on him. I just feel so... I know you do, I said, but don't. I told you this will never be your fault. It's not fair, though, he said. It's not fair. I looked at him, with his shaggy hair and baggy jeans, forgetting for a second the incredible intellect he possessed. He truly was just a kid, wasn't he? Never more so than in that moment. For everything he knew about the world, Owen was still learning the greatest lesson of them all. Life. Your turn, I said. Any luck at the Apple Store? Owen's update was a lot shorter, as he'd had no luck identifying the two guys who wanted us dead. The fact that I'd learned the first name of one of them didn't really change anything, but I had an idea what could. I need to get hold of Detective Lamont again, I said. Where is he? Hopefully still at home. His precinct patched me in last time. I took a step toward the hotel phone before stopping. Thoughts of my home line being tapped had jumped squarely in the way. Is there any chance they would have bugged Lamont's phone too? Owen didn't answer. He was suddenly glued to the television. I hadn't even realized it was on. The sound was down. What's up? I asked, pulling up alongside him. I literally had to nudge him to respond. What are you watching? Something pretty strange, he said. Chapter 49. Next to the CNN logo were the two favorite words of any news network. Breaking news. Above those words was Wolf Blitzer, presumably elaborating on the other two words filling the screen next to him. Bass out. Owen quickly grabbed the clicker, turning up the volume. No sooner could we actually hear the Blitzmeister, as Claire got such a kick out of calling him, did the scene cut to the East Room of the White House. The name Bass didn't register with me at first, but as soon as I saw him standing at the podium, I put it together. Lawrence Bass was supposed to be the next director of the CIA. Now here he was, flanked by the president on one side, his family on the other, announcing that he was withdrawing his name from consideration. Wasn't his confirmation hearing coming up pretty soon? I asked. That depends, said Owen. On what? If you think this morning qualifies as pretty soon. Owen had pegged it all right. That was pretty strange. On the flip side, Bass's rationale couldn't have been more common. Not only was he turning down the CIA director's post, he said he was leaving his current position as Director of Intelligence Programs with the National Security Council. Why? To spend more time with his family. Turn it up more, I said. Owen ramped the volume on the remote as we both sat down on the edge of the bed to watch. Some decisions are easy, others are hard, Bass explained, his hands tightly gripping the podium. And then there are the ones that are both. He turned to glance at his wife, who was corralling their young twin daughters, an arm draped over each of their shoulders. The girls, who looked to be around 7 or 8, were smiling, almost preening for the host of photographers before them. As for the wife, she was wiping away a tear. As honored as I was to be chosen by President Morris to lead the Central Intelligence Agency, I couldn't ignore the sacrifice it would require of my family, Bass continued. All my life, I've known only one way to approach a job, and that's with everything I have. That's what I would have brought to my job as CIA director, just as I did at the NSC. But in the end, there's an even more important job for me, and I already have it. That's to be the very best father and husband I can be. So as much as this was a hard decision for me in some ways, 3 very beautiful ways to be exact, it was an easy one. With that, he let go of the podium, stepped back, and hugged his wife and daughters. 1, 2, 3. The sound of cameras clicking away was nearly deafening, even through the television. Very touching, said Owen, as the screen switched back to Wolf Blitzer. He was introducing some pundit for comment. Yes, it was, I said. Owen turned to me. Each of us knew what the other was thinking. For a minute there, I almost believed him. Yeah, me too, I said. Chapter 50. A hot shower and some sleep used to do wonders for me. I'd wake up with that can-do attitude straight out of a breakfast cereal commercial, trumpeting all those essential vitamins and nutrients. Now I was just wondering if I'd live to see another breakfast. Not to say there weren't any saving graces. For instance, watching Owen hack one of those disgusting websites selling personal information about people was the best irony I'd seen in a long time. It looked simple, too. That is, until I asked Owen what he was actually doing. "It's called a structured query language injection," he explained. "SQL, for short. I trick the website into incorrectly filtering for string literal escape characters."
String literal escape characters? Structured query language injection?
"Carry on," I told him. The upshot was that we weren't taking any chances in communicating with Detective Lamont. That resulted in the second best irony I'd seen in a long time. We were evading the prospect of the highest of high-tech surveillance by going seriously old school.
"How did you know I had a fax machine at home?"
asked Lamont the moment we stepped into the back seat of his car that night outside what used to be the Juliet Supper Club near 21st Street and 10th Avenue. Given how many people had been either stabbed or shot at coming out of the place, I figured he'd know it well. "I'll let Owen tell you," I said, making the introduction. Nothing in my fax had mentioned I was bringing someone along, and certainly not someone so young.
"How old are you?" asked Lamont.
He was squinting, partly because there was barely any light in the car, but mostly due to disbelief.
19,
answered Owen.
Lamont turned to me. "My car's older than him."
I glanced around the interior of his Buick LeSabre, my eyes moving from the crank handles for the windows to the ashtray below the radio.
An ashtray?
"Your car's older than everybody," I said.
With that, the headlights of an oncoming car lit my banged-up face. We were still parked along the curb.
"Shit," said Lamont. "How did that happen?"
I told him the story. It also gave me a chance to thank him for tipping me off about my phone line.
"Call it a hunch," said Lamont. "The two guys who paid me a visit were CIA.
Owen chimed in. "Special Activities Division, right?"
"How did you know?" asked Lamont.
"Let's just say we share the same company health plan." Lamont shot me another look.
"He's 19? And he works for the CIA?
What other surprises do you have?" he asked.
Lamont had helped me up until this point based on little more than his gut. The time had come to prove his instincts right. I asked Owen to take out his phone and show Lamont some highlights from the hallway of the Lucinda Hotel.
"How's that for special activity?"
I said as we watched the body of Claire's killer being removed from the room. Then came the main attraction. The big picture, if you will. Owen showed Lamont the two recordings he'd played for me at the Oak Tavern. Even having seen them already, I got the same anxious, uneasy pit in my stomach feeling I'd had the first time. All of it was so painful to watch. And yet, that was all I could do. I couldn't take my eyes off the screen. As for Lamont, he remained completely silent. In fact, he barely even moved. I tried to imagine all the things he'd seen as a New York City detective. Much of that, I was sure, was far more unsettling from a blood and guts standpoint. But this was different. This had implications, the likes of which he most definitely hadn't seen before.
"We need a favor," I said as soon as the second recording was finished.
I half expected Lamont to shoot back,
"No, what you need is a federal grand jury."
This was the guy, after all, who'd warned me about trying to do other people's jobs. But that seemed like a very long time ago. A lot had changed, including Lamont.
"Let me guess," he offered,
nodding at Owen's phone.
"You have faces but no names."
"Exactly," I said. Lamont looked at me and nodded again. Sometimes a man's character reveals itself slowly, over months, maybe even years. Other times, all it takes is a New York minute.
"Yeah, I can help you," he said.
As he threw the car into drive and pulled away from the curb, he began to whistle. It was the first few bars of "Take Me Out to the Ball Game." "Buy me some peanuts and what?" Chapter 51. Lamont reached for his cell, tapping a speed dial number as we stopped at a red light at the corner of 10th Avenue. He waited a few seconds while the line rang. We all waited. After a couple more rings, someone picked up. It was a guy's voice. I could just make it out.
"Hey," the guy said, "where are you?" You're about to get an email from someone you don't know, Lamont said into the phone. I need you to do me a favor. Go ahead.
Hearing the voice for the second time, I recognized it. Lamont was talking to his partner, Detective McGeary.
There'll be 3 videos attached, Lamont continued. Load them into Cracker Jack and run that ID filter thingamajiggy.
I could hear McGeary chuckle.
You mean the ISO prep for facial recognition? Yeah, that's the one. What am I looking at?
McGeary asked.
That's the thing, said Lamont. You can't look at them, not even a glance. At least, not yet. You're joking, right? Just trust me on this, okay?
The line was silent for a few seconds.
Yeah, sure, McGeary said finally. Whatever. Thanks, partner, said Lamont. I'll see you shortly.
He hung up, turning to us in the back seat. Owen's fingers were already hovering over his phone, ready to type in McGeary's email address. Lamont gave it to him.
I need to send the files one at a time, said Owen. They're too big as a group.
Whatever it takes, said Lamont. As you could tell, I'm not the most tech-savvy guy in the world. All I know is that prepping files on that damn machine takes a while. This way we've got a head start.
Is he really not going to watch them? I asked, incredulous. That was like putting a biscuit on a dog's nose.
Yeah, I know, said Lamont.
Are you trying to protect him?
I'm trying to give him the option. I'll explain it to him at the precinct, and he'll make the decision. That way, he owns it, Lamont said. You can't unwatch what you just showed me.
Done, said Owen, looking up from his phone. All 3 sent.
Good, thanks, said Lamont, as the light turned green.
He turned left onto 10th Avenue, heading the only way you can, which is north. The traffic was one way.
Apparently, though, someone didn't get the memo. Jesus, look at this asshole, said Lamont, pointing up ahead.
Amid all the taillights was a pair of headlights, right smack in the middle of the street and coming right toward us, fast. The guy was either drunk or a tourist or both. Lamont flashed his high beams as drivers began leaning on their horns left and right. A taxi 50 feet ahead of us missed getting hit by inches as the oncoming car swerved around it at the last possible moment. Whoever it was wasn't stopping. If anything, he was picking up speed.
Get over,
I yelled at Lamont. But to his credit, he wasn't thinking only about us. Every car around us was in danger. Lamont jammed the brakes and reached down by the shotgun seat, grabbing a cherry top. There was no time to throw it up on the roof of his car. He quickly plunked it on the dash, flipping it on. I shielded my eyes as best I could to the blinding flashes of red and blue filling Lamont's car. Even more blinding was the white of the 2 headlights getting closer and closer. The car was right in our lane, and there was nothing between us. What the hell is happening?
Hold on, said Lamont.
Chapter 52. I braced for the collision. My arms outstretched, the palms of my hands pressed hard against the back of the front seat. Owen was doing the same. Lamont, white-knuckled, had the steering wheel gripped at 10-2. He was bound to get the worst of it. Is this LeSabre so old it doesn't even have airbags? I could already hear the crash in my head, the horrible crunch of metal against metal, of glass shattering, of Newton's first law being proven at 120 decibels. But those sounds never came. It was an entirely different one we heard, albeit just as loud. At the last possible second, the oncoming car came to a halt mere inches from our front grille, the tires screeching as if they were being ripped from their rims. I couldn't just smell the burnt rubber. I could taste it.
Son of a bitch! Shouted Lamont.
Whatever relief came from not being hit was quickly overtaken by his anger. He couldn't unbuckle his seatbelt fast enough to get out of the car and tear this driver a new one. With the cherry still spinning on the dash, he was barely more than a silhouette as he opened the door and swung his legs out all in one move. The moment his heels reached the asphalt, I could hear a door opening on the other car. Someone was getting out, another silhouette. But I still recognized him. So did Lamont. Just not fast enough. Before Lamont could even reach for his gun, the sound of shots split the air. There were 4 of them, right in a row. Pop, 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 pop. Instinctively, I ducked, but not before seeing Lamont drop to the ground, his hands clutching his chest. He was gasping, wheezing, trying to catch his breath. It was the sound of a man dying. All at once, I wanted to puke, to mourn him, to click my heels 3 times and wake up safe in my bed next to Claire. But all I could see was Owen right beside me, completely frozen. He couldn't have been more exposed if he'd had a neon target on his face. "Get down!" I screamed, grabbing his shoulders. As I pulled him flat against the back seat, the second wave came, as I'd known it would. There were so many shots I couldn't keep count, one after another riddling the windshield. I'd expected the sound of shattering glass, but not like this, not with bullets flying over us. Damn, my kingdom for my duffel. I'd left the bag back at the hotel, not wanting to bring what amounted to a small arsenal into Lamont's precinct. Call me crazy, but I wasn't that crazy. I reached down, grabbing the Glock, strapped to my right shin. With that and 2 extra clips, I had just enough for 1 plan. "Get ready," I said.
"For what?"
asked Owen. I flipped the safety. "We're getting out of here." Chapter 53. All I knew was that my ears would have to be my eyes. That flashing cherry meant I couldn't see out of the car, but it also meant he couldn't see in, he being Gordon's partner. It was him, all right. The gamble was whether it was only him. That was what I was hearing, though. Shots from only 1 gun. 1 gun which he was currently reloading. The slide and click were unmistakable. I could almost hear his thoughts, too. He knew I had a weapon. His buddy Gordon had a hole in his foot that proved it. "Sitting this one out, Gordo?" I sure as hell hoped so. There was no time for any countdown or a moment to steel my nerve. My window was now, and it looked a lot like the space between the front and back seats. The car was in park and idling, but not for long. "Go." I popped up like a deranged gun-toting whack-a-mole, firing blindly through the windshield and into the other car. As I unloaded half my clip, the only thing I was aiming for was to send Gordon's partner scrambling for cover. "Go!" I lunged over the seat, shifting into reverse with my gun hand while punching the gas with the other. Steering wasn't exactly a high priority as we took off backward with Owen sneaking peeks out the back window. "Clear!" he shouted, while I remained on the floor of the front seat. All the surrounding traffic had backed the hell away as soon as they heard the gunfire, more of which was now spraying through what remained of the windshield. Suffice it to say, Gordon's partner didn't particularly like this latest development. Meanwhile,
30 feet,
shouted Owen with the update, the distance before we'd hit another car, or anything else for that matter. By now it had stopped raining shards of glass over my head. We were out of range. Time to get a better view. I pulled myself up by the steering wheel, immediately spinning us into a 180 that nearly flipped us over and had Owen practically doing a somersault across the back seat.
"Jesus!"
he yelled.
"Sorry!"
I yelled back. The second we were on all 4 tires again, I grabbed the rearview mirror, twisting it into my eyeline to see what Gordon's partner was doing behind us. Instead, I should have been looking straight ahead.
"Car!"
said Owen.
"Car!"
I looked just in time to see a white BMW swerving up on the curb to avoid us. So did the taxi behind it. Now we were the asshole who didn't get the memo. We were going the wrong way. The chorus of horns kicked in, but the only car that really mattered was still behind us. Glancing into the rearview mirror again, I could just make out Gordon's partner getting back behind the wheel. For the first time, I could see what he was driving, a Jeep Wrangler. I killed the cherry and made the first turn possible onto 21st Street. We were finally going the right way, but it was clear we were about to have company. Just how fast can a Buick LeSabre from the early 80s go? Chapter 54. My right foot was like a cinder block on the gas, while my head was like a bobble doll, bouncing all around as I tried to see through the shot-up windshield. There were so many cracks and jagged edges, I might as well have been looking through a prism. I blew through 1 red light, and then another without a scratch. A double dose of lucky on our way to the West Side Highway. More lanes, less traffic, better chance of losing him. Or so I was thinking.
He's gaining,
said Owen, looking out the back while I frantically weaved in and out of the cars around us. How many behind? I asked.
5 cars, he said. Shit, make that 4.
We were a block away from the highway, but suddenly that idea wasn't looking so good. I couldn't shake him. 4 cars back would become 3, and then 2, and then 1, and he'd be right on my tail, shooting out my tires. I glanced back at Owen.
Time for plan B, I said. I didn't know we had a plan A.
Good, then you won't fight me on this. He fought me anyway.
Hell no,
he said, after I told him what I wanted to do.
It's 2 against 1.
Yeah, but we've got only 1 gun, I said. That makes it 1 against 1.
Then I'll be the decoy, he said. I'll distract him.
Yeah, right before he puts 4 bullets in your chest. It wasn't just what I said. It was the way I said it. Angry, pissed, guilty. All I could see was Lamont falling to the ground. It was playing in my head over and over, a vicious loop. And as Owen went silent, it was as if he knew exactly how I felt. He'd felt the same thing with Claire. I need you to run with this story, kid. Literally.
Okay, he said, relenting. But you better know what you're doing.
I do, I assured him. And with any luck, that wouldn't be a lie. Flipping the cherry back on, I looked up ahead to the end of the block about 50 yards away. I was straddling both lanes as parked cars dotted each side of the street like Morse code. What I needed was 2 cars lined up opposite each other like gateposts, because I was about to close the gate. The sound of my jamming the brakes was immediately drowned out by everyone else's brakes behind me. Not only was I stopping on a dime, I was stopping on an angle to block both lanes. Instant chaos. No one was going anywhere, except Owen.
Now,
I told him. He hesitated for a split second, but that was it. He burst out of the back seat, dashing around the corner and out of sight as fast and as low as he could. Now it was my turn. Only I was heading in the opposite direction. Suddenly, my life had become an existential fortune cookie. Man chased too long. Must find new path. Chapter 55. With the cherry still flashing on the dash, there came an eerie silence as I all but crawled out of the front seat on my hands and knees to avoid being seen. New York drivers have a well-earned rep for impatience, but even they know when to lay off their horns. You honk at a cop, and you're likely to see some real impatience. And that old Buick LeSabre blocking traffic was an unmarked police car, as far as everyone could tell. Everyone, that is, except the guy at the wheel 4 cars back who wanted me dead. Quickly, I made my way behind a Prius parked along the curb. The angle was wrong, though. I couldn't see well enough up the street. So much for the gift of silence, too. The line of cars now stretched all the way down the block, well beyond sight of the flashing red and blue. Any driver bringing up the rear had no idea why he was stopped. The horns began kicking in, one louder than the last. Fine by me. I was banking on the confusion. As fast as I got to the curb was how slowly I began moving alongside the parked cars, peering over the hoods until I had a clean line. But it wasn't happening. The headrest of a seat, a side-view mirror, something was always in the way. I should have been able to spot him by now. Finally, there came a good angle. I was maybe 20 feet away, sidled up next to the back tire of a Mini Cooper. Looking through the glass of the rear hatch, I had the perfect view. Of nothing. I could see the Jeep, but the driver's seat was empty. The engine was running, and I couldn't suppress the immediate thought that maybe I should have been too. Gripping my pistol with both hands, I was whipping it around like a pointer. Where are you? Over here? Over there? I didn't know whether to move or stay put. People were starting to get out of their cars. Some were yelling, others walking ahead for a closer look. No one knew what was happening, including me. Then with one glance to the left, I saw him. He poked his head out from behind the Prius back where I'd started. I'd gone to him, he'd come to me. We'd missed each other. He had no intention of letting that happen again. Like a bull out of the gate, he came at me, running with his arm raised. His first shot caromed off the sidewalk, mere inches to my left, the sound setting off screams up and down the block. People were scattering everywhere as I bolted around the next car at the curb, just barely eluding the second shot. Had the Mini Cooper been any less mini, I would have been nailed in the back for sure. 3.8 billion years of evolution tucked away in your DNA. Immediately, I spun around with my arms locked, the inside of my index finger flush against the trigger. Once again, I had the perfect view. And once again, it was of nothing. The sidewalk was empty. He wasn't there. But he was far from gone. Chapter 56. I've never cracked the cover of Sun Tzu's The Art of War. It's never even made the to-read pile next to my bed. But I had to believe that somewhere buried in the book was a rule that said, if the enemy knows where you are, but you don't know where the enemy is, move. As fast and low as I could, I zigzagged across the street, stopping only when I saw some bald guy in a suit halfway out of his shiny red Cadillac. He was crouched, looking through the window with his entire head exposed, as if he'd somehow missed that physics class in high school explaining the effect of a speeding bullet on a piece of glass. This just in, pal. The bullet wins. Hey, I tried whispering, which was pretty much a lost cause given the cacophony of horns still blaring. The entire street had become a parking lot, an exceedingly angry one at that. Hey, I tried again, louder. Finally, he turned around, and I motioned with both hands for him to get down. That immediately got me a look suggesting I should mind my own effing business. Then he saw the gun in my right hand. That did the trick. He ducked back into his seat so fast, he literally banged his bald head on the top of the car. Any other time, any other place, that would have been funny. I wasn't laughing. All I could do was keep looking left and right as I approached the other sidewalk, my head on a swivel. Forget my trigger finger. The slightest movement anywhere in front of me had my entire body twitching. Throw in some self-doubt, and I was close to drowning in my own sweat. Did I really need to go after a trained CIA field agent head-on? Too late. It was like lightning before the thunder. I first saw a flash in the corner of my eye. I turned quickly to look, squinting for focus, and heard a booming voice right behind it. The voice was saying something. He was saying something. But he was too far away. I couldn't make out the words. The voice, though. I knew the voice. It was familiar. It was Owen. He was sprinting toward me on the sidewalk, his cell phone lit up with one of those flashlight apps. Damn, those things are bright. He was close enough now, the words beginning to come together. You! He was screaming. Find you! Find me? No. Behind me! I spun around, hands out front, my eyes blowing up wide with panic, as I looked out over the barrel of my pistol to see another gun already lined up with my chest. Somehow he'd gotten behind me. Now he was right in front of me, dead center. All Gordon's partner had to do was pull the trigger. But he suddenly had a problem. He couldn't see me. The light from Owen's phone hit his face so fast, I could practically see his pupils snap shut. He raised his arm to shield his eyes, but it was the other arm I was watching. The one with the gun. He was swinging it right at Owen. There was no thought, no planning, no decision. Just instinct. And maybe a little trace memory thrown in for good measure in case he was wearing a bulletproof vest. In other words, I aimed a little bit higher. I got off two shots. I couldn't tell if the first one hit him, but there was no doubt about the second. Let's just say it was going to be a closed casket funeral and leave it at that. Come on, said Owen. Let's go. That was all he said. Or maybe that was all I heard. For sure, it was more than I was able to say. Which was nothing. I could barely breathe, let alone talk. But I was keenly aware. The kid came back for me. Later, I would thank him. The heart rate would slow. The thoughts and words would come. I'd point out that this was the second time he'd saved my life. I'd even crack that I'd never been so happy to have someone ignore what I'd asked him to do. If Owen had fled back to the hotel from Lamont's car, as I'd asked, as he'd told me he would, I would have been the one lying on the pavement in a pool of blood. But he hadn't, so I wasn't. Yes. Later, I would do all this. when there was time to think and sort things out. But the moment after I pulled the trigger was no different than the moment right before. No thought, no planning, no decision, just instinct. The same instinct Owen had. Let's go. Chapter 57. I went to sleep having killed a man. I woke up thinking I'd at least find out who he was. It didn't matter if he wasn't carrying ID. There were other ways. So many other ways. Fingerprints, dental records, facial recognition software. If ever there was a job for Cracker Jack. What time is it? I asked Owen with my one good eye open off the pillow. My head was killing me. The rest of me wasn't feeling much better. Owen was sitting on the edge of the other queen bed in our two-room bunker at the Stonington, staring intently at the television and the start of the local morning news. He could have been a statue if it hadn't been for his hands. They were doing that dry wash thing again. What's the deal with that? It's 6, he answered. That explained the hint of daylight along the perimeter of the drawn curtains, not to mention why I still felt so tired. It was barely dawn, and I'd only been asleep for a couple of hours. Longer than Owen, though, apparently. There's one exception to the age-old maxim about news reporting, if it bleeds, it leads, and that's the early morning broadcast. At the start of the day, one thing trumps everything else. The weather. Short of an apocalypse, that's what people want to hear about first. The eternal question? It's not the meaning of life. It's, will I need an umbrella? According to the far too chipper weatherman pointing out some incoming clouds on the Doppler radar, the answer was a definite maybe. There was a 40% chance of showers in the afternoon. Of course, there was a 100% chance of 2 shooting deaths overnight in the Chelsea section of Manhattan. The weatherman, still grinning, sent it back to the anchor, who did her best to segue into a more somber tone as the words, "Detective Death," appeared on screen. Next to them was a picture of Lamont. He must have fallen to the ground 1,000 times in my mind before I'd finally been able to drift off to sleep. Now tell us who the goddamn son of a bitch was who killed him. Tell us about Gordon's partner. As if he could read my mind, Owen stopped rubbing his hands and glanced back over his shoulder at me. They're not gonna know, he said softly. The second he said it, I knew he was right. Even if the police did know, they wouldn't be quick to release the name to the press. It would raise more questions than answers. At this time, the identity of the second victim, who is believed to be the man responsible for Detective Lamont's murder, is unknown, said the anchor, so keyed to her teleprompter that she didn't seem to even grasp how twisted that sounded. Even more so because there wasn't even a mention of the other trigger man. Me. Was there really no one who saw me shoot him? The anchor moved on to a fire in a Queens tenement building, prompting Owen to shut off the television. As soon as he turned to me, I knew the question coming, and it certainly wasn't about how I'd slept. How do you want to do this? He asked. That was the part we hadn't discussed after returning to the hotel. The how. Our focus had been the what, as in, what do we do now? The night had changed everything. Detective Lamont was dead, and we knew why. We owed it to him, his family, and everyone he worked with to come forward. Maybe Owen was right. Maybe justice wouldn't be served in the end. But it no longer seemed like our call to make. Lamont's precinct, I said. I think that's where we begin. Owen nodded. Do you want to call ahead? No, let's just show. Before I could get the word up out of my mouth, Owen's phone lit up on top of his backpack by the TV. I thought it was an incoming call at first, but there was no ring, no buzzing or vibrating. That's strange, said Owen, going over to check it. What is? I asked. It's an email. So? I shouldn't be getting any, he said. The account uses an entity authentication mechanism I designed myself. It's way beyond the X509 system. I stared at him blankly. Okay, now in English, I said. It means that for me to get an email, it has to be piggybacked on one I already sent. But I only set up the account yesterday. I haven't sent an email to anyone. No sooner did he say it than we both realized he was wrong. He had sent an email to someone, from Lamont's car. What's it say? I asked, watching him read. Owen tossed me the phone so I could see for myself. It was more than an email. It was hope. Underneath a screen grab from one of the interrogation videos were a name and an address in Washington, D.C. Georgetown, to be exact. "My partner always believed in what he was doing," McGeary added. "I hope you do, too." Book 3. Trust No One. Not Even Yourself. Chapter 58. It doesn't matter if you don't know a door card from a river card, or whether a full house beats a flush. Anyone old enough to see the inside of a Las Vegas casino can walk right into the poker room at the Bellagio. Walking into Bobby's room is a different story. Bobby's room, named after Bobby Baldwin, the 1978 World Series of Poker champion, is the poker room inside the poker room at the Bellagio. It features two high-stakes tables that are completely walled off from the other 40-some-odd tables, complete with a polished-looking host, a maitre d' of sorts, who stands guard at the door to make sure none of the riffraff ever make it in. Minimum buy-in is 20 grand. The games being played, however, almost always require a much bigger bankroll. Much bigger. On the one hand, Bobby's room caters to a very privileged clientele. On the other hand, there remains a certain egalitarian element, especially if that other hand is clutching a boatload of money. Better yet, a yachtload. Truth is, almost any Tom, Dick, or Harry flashing a lot of cash is more than welcome to play in Bobby's room. That goes for any Valerie, too. Valerie Jensen, dressed in a leather Chanel skirt, a silk Valentino blouse, and a pair of red Christian Louboutin lady peeps, handed the host at the door a house marker for $200,000 with the carefree ease of someone who had plenty more where that came from. The fact that she didn't was the first lesson her father, a professional gambler, had taught her when she was a little girl back in Somers, New York. Poker is a game of lies. If you want to tell the truth, go to confession. "Gentlemen, I'd like you to meet Beverly Sands," announced the host as he pulled out the lone empty chair at the table for Valerie. It was the three seat, three spots to the left of the dealer. Valerie, aka Beverly Sands, sat down amid the polite nods from the other players. Save one, they were all pros. She looked around the table. She'd seen them numerous times before on TV, playing tournaments. And more times than not, they were winning those tournaments. But as attractive as Valerie was, stunning, really, not a single pro allowed himself the slightest gawk or ogle. That would be a sign of weakness. Never show weakness at the poker table. That was the second lesson Valerie's father had taught her. This one doubled as a life lesson, his mantra all during the battle with the lung cancer that ultimately took his life, but never his spirit. Never show weakness, period. "Two," said the host, giving the dealer what would have been the peace sign anywhere else. In Bobby's room, it meant give the lady $200,000 in chips, which was what the dealer promptly did after gathering up the pile of cards in front of him. A hand had just finished. The game was No Limit Texas Hold'em. Two cards face down to each player, followed by five share cards in the middle. Best five from the seven wins. Simple as that. Of course, if it were really that simple, there wouldn't be nearly 1,000 books out there dedicated to explaining how the game should be played. Given the high stakes, there were no blinds to jumpstart the betting. Instead, every player had a $500 ante. This meant Valerie wouldn't have to wait for the dealer button to come around her way. She could be dealt in immediately. With the speed of a robotic arm on a Detroit assembly line, the dealer placed the cards from the last hand in the automatic shuffler to his right and pulled out the second of the two decks used in the game. After a quick cut, he began to deal, giving Valerie a few seconds to look around the table again. Her father's voice was so clear in her head. It was as if he were back from the grave, sitting right there next to her. "There's a fish in every poker game. That's the player who's in way over his head. If you look around the table and can't spot him, get the hell up immediately, because you're the fish." Valerie smiled to herself. She wasn't going anywhere. Her fish was seated directly across the table in the eighth seat. He was the only other non-pro at the table, but everyone knew who he was. That's just the way it is with multimillionaires. When you land in Vegas in your own Gulfstream G650, it's tough to fly under the radar. Shahid al-Dasari was a Saudi Arabian banker who was purportedly an advisor to the Saudi royal family, among other things. He was handsome, he was charismatic, and he was currently under investigation for money laundering by the U.S. government, including Special Agent Valerie Jensen. "It's your action, Miss Sands," said the dealer with a slight nod. The betting had been checked around to her. Valerie reached for the sunglasses that had been resting in her blonde hair, dropping them down across her blue eyes. Slowly, she lifted up her two hole cards on their edges, pulling them toward her across the felt as if she were giving the table a shave. "Game on. This one's for you, Dad." Chapter 59. Valerie wasn't sure when the exact moment would come, only that it was coming. It could take an hour, maybe upward of 3 or 4, or maybe only 20 minutes, over and done lickety-split. The cards had to cooperate, of course, but so did al-Dasari, and so far he was. Educated in the States, Yale undergrad, Wharton MBA, al-Dasari was as Americanized as a Saudi could ever be. He loved Tennessee whiskey, New York Fashion Week, and shoot-'em-up Hollywood movies. But most of all, what he loved was women. He worshipped them. Never mind that they were treated like second-class citizens back in his homeland. That was there. He was here. America. Where women had all the power. Just so long as they were pretty. While the pros at the table maintained their well-trained discipline, paying far more attention to the action in the middle of the table than to the eye candy seated at one end of it, Shahid al-Dasari was a man distracted. Never a good thing in a high-stakes poker game. In fact, 45 minutes after sitting down, Valerie was fairly convinced that the only reason he flat-called her raise from out of position was so he would have an excuse to introduce himself, maybe even flirt a little. The moment had come. Valerie had raised the initial bet of $2,500, making it $10,000. Al-Dasari called quickly, while the remaining players all folded, including the initial bettor. That left just Valerie and al-Dasari in the hand. Heads-up action, as the saying goes. The dealer promptly buried a card and proceeded to turn up 3 cards in front of him, otherwise known as the flop. 7 of clubs, 9 of hearts, 8 of hearts. It wasn't just any flop. It was an action flop. There were straight possibilities, flush possibilities. In fact, with 2 cards still to come, there were very few hands that weren't a possibility at this point. The betting was on al-Dasari, who promptly checked with a silent tap of the felt. Valerie had been the one who'd raised pre-flop, so this was hardly a surprise move. She had control of the hand, but the only way to keep it that way was for her to increase the pot, a continuation bet. 20,000, she said, reaching for her chips. Behind her sunglasses, though, she wasn't looking at her chips. Her eyes were focused on al-Dasari, hoping to see a reaction of some kind, a tell, that would give away the strength of his hand. But he barely blinked. Instead, he snap-called her, tossing 2 $10,000 chips into the pot. So much for the easy way, thought Valerie. Besides, easy was boring. Again, the dealer buried a card before flipping over the turn, the 4th card, face up next to the other 3. It was the ace of diamonds. The betting opened with al-Dasari, who checked as he'd done before. As much as he was staring at Valerie, he still hadn't said anything. At least, not out loud. The fact that he'd called her last 2 bets, though, was definitely telling her something. It was time to find out more. "You wouldn't happen to be stringing me along, would you?" asked Valerie, flashing the most disarming smile she could muster. Al-Dasari kept his stare, and for a moment or two remained silent. But it was no use. Beverly Sands, the buxom blonde dressed to the nines, was exactly his type. She was his Miss America. "I was actually thinking the same thing myself, that you were stringing me along," he said, smiling back with perfect teeth. "I've been known to have a weakness for women." That got a few knowing chuckles from around the table. Al-Dasari's reputation preceded him. "So that ace of diamonds on the turn didn't help you?" asked Valerie. Al-Dasari dropped a forearm on the padded rail of the table, leaning forward over his stack of chips. "Who said I needed help?" And there it was, an absolute rarity at the poker table.
Someone telling the truth.
Aldassari had a made hand. Valerie was sure of it. Because that's what men do when they're trying to impress a woman. They talk too much.
In that case, I'll check as well, she said.
With a simple tap on the felt, Valerie surrendered any leverage she had in the hand. But leverage can be a tricky thing. And there was still one more card to be played. Chapter 60. The dealer tapped the table with a closed fist, the deck cradled tightly in the palm of his left hand. He peeled off the burn card before turning over the final card, the river. It was a jack of spades. The board was now complete. 7 of clubs, 9 of hearts, 8 of hearts, ace of diamonds, jack of spades. Gone was the chance of a flush or anything higher on the pecking order of poker hands. Still, there remained a lot of possibilities. A pair, 2 pair, 3 of a kind, a straight, and of course, nothing at all, which on paper would be the worst hand you can have. But poker isn't played on paper. For those with the balls to bluff, the worst hand can easily turn into the winning hand. Those same balls are what usually separate the pro from the amateur, or the sharks from the fish. Aldassari, however, wasn't bluffing when he reached for his chips to open the final round of betting. Valerie had already seen the way he glanced at her stack to see how much she had left. Bet sizing was as much a part of no-limit hold'em as anything else.
25,000,
he said, slowly sliding the chips out in front of him. The amount was a little less than half the pot, not exactly small, but hardly big enough to force Valerie off a decent hand. Aldassari was making the classic value bet. He wanted her to call. But Valerie had no intention of calling. Raise, she announced. She made a move for her chips and then stopped, instead resting her forearms against the railing. It looked like indecision, maybe even nerves. At the very least, Valerie wanted it to appear as if she were thinking, doing the math in her head and then doing it again while trying to calculate the right amount to come over the top of Aldassari and get him to fold.
Once again, my darling daughter, poker is a game of lies.
There was no more thinking to be done, no more math either. Valerie already knew there was no chance that Aldassari was going to fold. Finally, she lifted her hands, gathering them behind her entire stack of chips. That motion meant the same thing at every poker table in every language, but it wouldn't be gambling, or any damn fun for that matter, if you didn't say the 3 words out loud in crystal clear English. I'm all in, she declared. Aldassari didn't ask the dealer for a count of how much he needed to match her bet, nor did he give it much thought. He simply continued staring at Valerie for another few seconds, oblivious to the other woman who just sidled up next to her, Lady Luck.
I call, he said.
Valerie was supposed to show her cards first, but Aldassari couldn't wait. If he wasn't about to win the hand outright, he thought for sure it would be a chopped pot, that they would both have the same straight. Confidently, he turned over his 2 hole cards.
I flopped it, he said.
Valerie, along with the rest of the table, looked at his 6 of clubs and 10 of clubs. Sure enough, the first 3 cards on the board, of 7 of clubs, 9 of hearts, 8 of hearts, ace of diamonds, jack of spades, had given him a 10 high straight. It was a made hand, and the best hand, even after the ace of diamonds on the turn. But then came the river. Saying nothing, Valerie reached for her cards. Everyone else at the table, all the pros, knew what she was about to turn over. She was no fish, and neither were they. Aldassari looked across the felt to see the 10 of diamonds and queen of diamonds staring back at him. Valerie had a queen high straight. It was the nuts, the best hand possible. The pot? Over $400,000. Aldassari's expression? Priceless. But not because he was upset. He couldn't care less about the money, nor did he care about losing to a woman. In fact, it was quite the opposite, and exactly what Valerie was betting on. Aldassari was more than intrigued. He was aroused. The fish was on the hook, all right. Now it was time to reel him in. Chapter 61. Dealer, where would I find the ladies' room? Asked Valerie, calmly raking in the pot.
The question wasn't exactly the prototypical reaction after winning a big hand. In fact, a few of the pros around the table even let go with wry smiles.
All in a day's work, right, lady?
If they only knew. Poker pros were awfully